This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Orange County School Board just voted to approve next year's budget. Included in the budget, extra funding for school resource officers, or SROs. Activists say putting additional resource officers in schools elevates the risk of over-policing and helps foster a school-to-prison pipeline. One of the groups that's been pushing back at the school district's SRO plan is Central Florida Jobs with Justice. Well, Denise Diaz is co-director of Central Florida Jobs with Justice. Denise, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So one of the things that Jobs with Justice has been trying to bring some attention to is funding for school resource officers. And the Orange County School Board voted on Tuesday night to approve a budget. They had some money in there for, I believe, expanding the school resource officer program. I wonder if you just kind of talk through some of the concerns of your organization and what you're trying to get the school board to do.
Yeah, so our organization is really concerned with excessive policing at OCPS. And so what we saw and understood was that between last year's approved budget and last night, that OCPS brought on 21 additional SROs for middle schools and even signed an MOU increasing how much they pay into for SRO salaries. And so, you know, this is concerning because the law, the Marjorie Douglas Stoneman law, only requires one SRO per school. And by putting in two to three, which is what OCPS is doing, and now at middle schools, they're really taking an excessive interpretation of that law. So we were trying to get them to come back to one SRO per school.
And so do you feel like your message resonated with them? I mean, did you get some positive response? Because obviously the budget meeting was kind of the last in a series of discussions about it. Like, what was the response so far?
You know, it was really interesting on how some school board members were in this place where they didn't, you know, they were asking a lot of questions, which was positive. However, what was abundantly clear for us is like that Orange County Public Schools, like their budget process is not transparent and it's really not accessible to parents and community stakeholders, right?
Why is that? Because I mean, the school board meetings are open to the public, right? And in some ways, even more so now because they're online and anybody can just kind of hop on and observe, right?
Yeah, but what I mean is they approved the budget last year and within that time, they brought on more SROs than what they, even though the budget, right, like after the budget that was approved, they brought in more without input from the budget.
And so what are some of the negative implications of having more school resource officers on a campus? Because I can see the argument from the school board or from, you know, administrators might be that, well, we think it's a good idea for security. I mean, there's concern from parents sometimes around school safety, and there's a number of reasons why a school might say it's a good idea to have a law enforcement presence on campus.
Yeah, I can tell you I'm a parent of three children, two middle schoolers and an elementary schooler. This is what I think about is safety. Now with this pandemic, think about even differently, right, of what safety means. But I think it's important to reconsider how we're saying what harm it, right? And that children also being over policed and even arrested are experiencing harm and could be acting out because their mental and emotional well-being is not being met, right? And so you have to have a much more holistic approach to that than just more law and order in schools.
If the school district goes ahead and does actually, you know, hire these extra school resource officers, are there some things that you're going to ask them to try and do to make sure that officers, you know, are acting in a way that's consistent with the best interests of the kids? And you know, we don't see situations like, for example, the six-year-old who was arrested by a school resource officer who was later fired by the chief of police.
Yeah, and so this is where just beyond that, we, you know, having the school board really define through their code of conduct, you know, where discipline ends and at what point are we bringing SROs and what are their roles, right? Because if that's all you have, and our organization heard from a couple of parents around that SROs are being used inappropriately, in the sense of like, if a child is not wearing a mask, then you bring in an SRO, right? That's not, that's a bit excessive, right? So I think really defining the role of the SRO and really looking at the code of conduct to really represent the essence of trying to keep our students safe and what that means.
Are you confident that that code of conduct will be adhered to going forward?
You know, I think it's important. I think it's really important for, you know, the school board to understand that this is something that they should be working more closely with community stakeholders and parents. So they can't do it alone, and they're really going to have to collaborate with stakeholders around this. I'm confident that working with, hearing the feedback, being more transparent about this process and when these changes are made is what's going to get us to that place. Yeah.
Have you looked at what other school districts around the state have done? I mean, are there some models you can point to and say, look, here's a school district that's doing it right?
Yeah, and what we have seen, for example, in Miami-Dade, which is a large district, as well as Duval, they are actually do have are meeting adhering to the one SRO per school, and their school-based arrests are smaller. And so that tells you that very clearly, also in Palm Beach, that more police you have on campus, the more school-based arrests you will have, right? And so I think that clearly stands out with these also large districts in the state of, you know, the role of the SRO and what else could we be doing with safety coordinators, intervention programs, and so forth.
Denise, this is a moment where there's a lot more scrutiny, right, on law enforcement, you know, not just in schools, obviously, but in cities and towns across the country. And we've seen a wave of protests sweeping across the United States, including here in Central Florida, over police brutality. Does it feel like now is a good moment to be drawing attention to the role of resource officers particularly and try to make, you know, hold school boards and school districts to account when it comes to how officers are deployed and you know, the impact that their actions may have on students?
I think so. I think now is a time where school boards need to evaluate how, if they are perpetuating the school-to-prison pipeline, and really being the catalyst for that, which then leads to a lifelong for a lot of Black and brown kids growing up to be conditioned to being policed, right? And so this is one of the places where we need to look at this and get to the root of these problems. If we're really saying that Black Lives Matter, then we really have to look at institutions and the way in which systemically that is not being seen, right? So I think this is the time, if ever, and certainly in this pandemic where we're reimagining safety.
What's next for Jobs with Justice? Do you have like a strategy going forward, things that you want to talk to the school district or the school board about?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the next coming months, it's going to be around seeing how, for example, these 21 SROs and schools that have more, middle schools that have more than one SRO, how is that really playing out with students, right? And what are they being used for? So this is a good opportunity to get back into the community, talk to parents, talk to students, and also really try to work with school board members and even the superintendent, Barbara Jenkins, to really understand that this is a problem.
Well, Denise Diaz, co-director of Central Florida Jobs with Justice, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew.
Well, I also spoke with school board member Angie Gallo. She's in her first term on the school board. She's also co-chair of the Florida Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence. I wanted to ask you some questions, Angie, if I could, about school resource officers. Obviously, as you know, there are some organisations that are kind of pushing back a little bit at the school district and saying there doesn't need to be as many school resource officers as are budgeted for. I wonder if you could just kind of lay out what exactly the board voted on and sort of what that looks like in terms of how many SROs per campus there are going to be going forward.
Sure. So basically in the budget that was approved last evening, what we approved was we have two SROs at our high schools because our high schools are quite large. We have one to two at our middle schools, depending. We have many SROs, which are what we call relief SROs. So according to the state law, we have to have an SRO on campus for bell-to-bell coverage. So, you know, because there is COVID and because there is vacations and people, you know, FMLA and SROs can take time off, we keep SROs on hand that rotate from campus to campus and fill those needs as necessary alone.
What do you think about the argument, though, from folks who say, look, there's a risk of over-policing? And, you know, there have been some instances. I mean, some of them have got a lot of publicity. For example, that case last year where, a six-year-old was arrested and put in handcuffs and there was an outcry over that, and justifiably so. Like, do you think there is a risk of going down that path?
Well, that was a charter school. That didn't happen at a public school. So I just, at a traditional public school or at OCPS, so I want to be clear about that.
Sure.
But I think we always need to be cognizant of that. I think having an SRO in a school or two SROs in a school should be viewed as a good thing. I mean, these SROs should be building community relations with the kids, with the parents, especially in our high needs or our marginalized districts, our lower socioeconomic schools. I mean, their presence there is important, because those communities need to learn to trust law enforcement officers. With that being said, we do need to make sure that we have training, and we've done due diligence when we screen them to make sure that we don't have any SRO on our campus that has any type of grievances on their record that really should preclude them from being on our campus. I mean, we need to make sure that when we're screening them, we're looking for those type of offenses. And we want to make sure that we have programs in place for our kids. You know, not every kid needs to be arrested. We've really done a good job on civil citations over the last few years. They're on the rise. You know, we're trying to do a better job with our restorative justice program, which is another alternative program that really cuts down on repeat offenders. So we need to look at programs. We need to look at screenings. We need to make sure that our SROs are trained. And we need to have clear, definitive guidelines on the difference, the role of an SRO versus the role of our disciplinary, you know, admin that's on that school campus. And that needs to be clearly delineated so that there's no guessing in between on when an SRO should be called and when it's just strictly discipline and it should be handled by, you know, the dean of discipline at that school.
Yeah, and has that been an issue in the past? Because that would be one of the complaints, right? Like, if there's, you know, a class where some kid is just getting a bit unruly, is it really necessary to bring in a police officer or a sheriff's deputy and put them in handcuffs? Or should that be something that a teacher or school staff should be able to deal with themselves?
Oh, absolutely. The dean of discipline or the principal or whoever's in charge of discipline at that school should be the one handling, you know, those type of issues. An SRO should not be called in to a discipline issue like that. It should go through the school first. It should always be handled by the school first, unless it's a safety. You know, I mean, we're in very uncertain times. We see how bad things happen, especially, you know, in the wake of Marjory Stoneman Douglas. So we need to be vigilant, and we need to make sure that everybody's safe, but we also need to make sure that our kids feel safe at school. And it is our kids in those lower socioeconomic areas that usually feel less safe when a cop is or a law enforcement officer is at a school. So we need, you know, I think that we could definitely do a better job, you know, through training. Our two-year contract is up. We start, I think, renegotiating at the beginning of next year. We are going to implement some of those screening tools that I just talked about to make sure that everybody who is on our campus has passed all through the screen. And like I said, there's no offenses that would lead us to believe that they have any errors in their past that would warrant them not being on our campus. And we will look into sensitivity training. We provide it now, but I think we're going to do a more robust training. This is all stuff we'll be talking about in a work session. We're going to have a work session as a school board to really have an in-depth conversation about what happens now. You know, what can we do better? What do we need to put in place? As a school board member, and I'm also the co-chair of the Florida Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence, we were formed after the Pulse shooting to try to bring about common sense gun legislation to Florida. And we fought as a coalition extremely hard to only have SROs in schools because we believe that a sworn law enforcement officer is the safest person in that school if there's going to be an active school shooter. We do not want guardians. We do not want school safety officers. That could be anybody that goes through that guardian training. So as a school board member, I feel strongly that we need SROs on our campus, and those SROs keep our kids safe. And it's a good thing and should be viewed as a good thing, not a bad thing. But I also understand where we are as a country and the need for us in abundance of caution to do everything that we can to make sure that every kid from all different places feel safe when they walk onto our campus and what that looks like. And that, I think that's what we'll kind of dive into during the work session.
I wanted to ask about the work session too and kind of how that rolls out, but I did want to ask a question too about, you know, safety and school shootings in particular, and just point out as well that, as you know, there was a, you know, an SRO on campus at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and, you know, that case aside, oftentimes these shootings unfold in the space of seconds. It happens very quickly, and I'm just wondering, I mean, is there data to back up the idea that having a school resource officer on campus actually can do anything to help prevent a school shooting?
I think having a better chance with a sworn law enforcement officer than you would a guardian or a teacher that's carrying, or somebody that you hire that you put through training that's carrying a gun, for a couple of reasons. Number one, the ongoing training that a sworn law enforcement officers receive, plus they have access, they're carrying their radios, they have access to information that's going around in the community. So if they know that somebody has been spotted with a gun in the car and they're headed to the school, they'll know ahead of time that they need to lock down the school and try to keep it safe. So hopefully we could shut down, you know, anything bad that might happen. But as far as the data goes, we could probably find some data that says yes, kids are safer with an SRO. I don't know if that would negate that there's true research there that shows that more black and brown kids are arrested when you have a law enforcement officer on campus. I've seen that research, which is why we do have to be diligent and be aware of it and make sure that everybody's trained so that doesn't happen, and delineate and have very clear roles of what SROs should do. That only makes sense. I mean, we got to be smart about it. But the state law requires that we have one of those three on our campus. You know, we have to have bell-to-bell coverage. And as a school board member, I would never want to put my kids in harm's way and not have an SRO on our campus. If we have to have one on our campus, I would prefer that it is a sworn law enforcement. And I just want to do due diligence and make sure that we've done everything within our power through training, through, you know, our student code of conduct of clearly defining the SRO versus, you know, our the discipline role, so that we just make sure that those kids aren't targeted or aren't unduly arrested for unnecessary things. That's, none of us want to create a school to prison pipeline. We've worked so hard on civil citations and, you know, restorative justice and those type of programs because we recognize that a kid, you know, education is the ultimate equalizer. A kid needed to stay in school and be educated, and that's how they build their way out. And that's what we want for our kids, is for them to be successful.
So as far as these work sessions or other kind of discussions you might have, will you be inviting some of the folks who've been raising concerns, like, for example, the folks from Jobs with Justice and other people who've been speaking out and saying, look, maybe take another look at the school resource officer ratio that you have at Orange County Public Schools?
Yeah, so in our work session, and it hasn't been scheduled yet, but I've been told that it's coming. We've just been, there's been a lot of moving parts. So it's really, during work sessions, we usually don't have speakers at those work sessions because it's just an opportunity for us to have, they can attend. They can most definitely attend and listen to us. They can send us emails. We do like open up a comment section and we take public comment through emails that we can review. I've spoken to members of that group. I'm friends with several of them. So I've had conversations with them about what they want to see, what they're concerned about. I've talked to Representative Smith, you know, about his concerns. And, you know, like I said earlier, we could always do better. So, I mean, I think just in to be as transparent as possible, let's dive in and let's see where we are. Let's see where it makes sense. Or maybe we could, if there's something we need to change, let's change it. And let's just make sure that we are using our finances to the best possible way we can, because, you know, it's going to be tight with this COVID world we're living in. So I'm open to having those conversations and really looking at it to make sure that we're doing everything that we can.
Well, Angie Gallo is a school board member representing District 1 with Orange County Public Schools. Angie, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Still to come, what does it mean to defund the police? We'll revisit a conversation with Daytona Beach activist Rel Black and Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Nationwide protests over police brutality began in May over the killing of George Floyd, a black man who died in police custody in Minneapolis. And they've continued. In recent weeks, protesters have called for justice for Jacob Blake, who was shot in the back by police in Wisconsin. And in Orlando, activists want answers after a 22-year-old man, Salathius Melvin, was shot and killed by a sheriff's deputy last month. One rallying cry at protests has been to defund police. We're going to revisit a conversation about the issue that we aired on Intersection in June.
In the weeks of protest across the country after the death of George Floyd, there have been calls to change police use of force policies and calls to defund the police. And law enforcement agencies are making changes, in some cases requiring officers to step in if they see inappropriate use of force. But what does defund the police actually mean? Well, joining me for a conversation about protest and police reform is Rel Black. He's the founder of the Daytona Beach Nonprofit Community Healing Project. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon. Peace and love, everybody. Peace and love. Thank you for having me.
How many protests have you been involved in or helped coordinate in the past? And I'm wondering, just kind of thinking back to other movements, what feels different about now?
Gotcha. Altogether, I'll just say my organization, Community Healing Project, we've been initiated since about 2016. So we've been featured in numerous protests, from Sandra Bland to the Eric Garner situation, Mike Brown situations. I actually went down to Sanford, Florida when Trayvon Martin was killed about 8-9 years ago. So I've been out here. I'm very active. I'm very very mobile. When I say we're always at any protest, we try to get to at least every demonstration we can in our county. It's been exciting just to see that people that normally, you know, aren't as political, or people that normally don't voice their opinions, they're out there with us. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a woman in a wheelchair literally protesting with us. And we walked the bridge. We walked our International Speedway bridge and back. We walked to City Hall and marched and protested. You know, and there were people out there for 12 hours with us. You know, so I just think right now it's a change. You got to remember, people have been in their homes for 3 and 4 months, you know, with no money, nothing to do, barely any food, you know, children haven't been in school. So everyone's tense right now. So when something like this happens, which was so ugly and disgusting, and it, you know, it finally brings everyone together, and people are finally saying, you know what, I have a right to protest, I have a right to petition, let's do it, let's finally make some noise. So, like I said, I'm very excited right now to be a millennial, and to be a black man, I'm excited to see people finally understand what we've been trying to say the last 400 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rel Black. He is the founder of the Community Healing Project in Daytona Beach. We're talking about the notion of defunding the police, or police reform at the very least, the protests that have swept the nation in the last couple of weeks. Rel, you mentioned the protests in Sanford, Florida in 2012. And, I mean, those were pretty big affairs. They garnered a lot of attention, not just nationally, but internationally too. And, you know, thousands of people pouring through the streets of a pretty sleepy town. Did that feel like a moment of change?
I'll say this. I'm only 27, so I was about 18. I would say about 18 or 19. I remember I just graduated from high school when that situation happened. So maybe from lack of experience or lack of just life lessons, when we all heard that not guilty verdict, and, you know, we saw protests, you know, a lot of us were kind of confused. I was confused. I didn't understand, you know, how could this happen? How could this man walk? How are there laws in place that would allow someone to commit a heinous crime, not against a black child, but against a child, regardless if they're black or white? They did it against a child. and now they're able to walk around and sell that gun and do all that stuff. So that really inspired me at a young age. So I started a blog. It was called Rails Reviews. And I just used to talk about different stuff in the news. I used to talk about different political issues. And, of course, a lot of my friends didn't really, you know, they didn't really support because we were young then. But that was the basis of what my activism started. And I think the difference between the Trayvon Martin situation and the George Floyd situation is because Trayvon Martin was really the catalyst, I would almost say, to this new black movement of speaking out and demanding change. You know, before that, we had incidents. We had a lot of incidents, like the Model Diablo situation in New York, and there was the young man, Corey Bell, that was shot and killed by the police officers. There was the Gina Six. There have been a lot of incidents, but I think with Trayvon Martin, it really hit home because we had a black president at the time. You know, for a lot of us, and I'm just speaking of my community, for a lot of us, we felt secure. We felt a level of comfortability with Obama, President Obama, that we had never felt before. You know, so for not only Trayvon Martin, but then for Sandra Bland to be murdered, and for Mike Brown to be murdered, for Eric Garner to be murdered, you know, all these things kept happening. And then Tamir Rice and Philando Castile, all these things kept happening under a black president. And so I think the last 8 or so years, this generation now, we're in our 20s now. We're almost 30. We're the ones out here speaking up because we're just sick of it. And it's getting to the point where there's nothing happening substantially. There's no consequences really being made. So we're really speaking out. And a lot of people are choosing to use their voice. A lot of people are, you know, going out and causing a ruckus. And hey, I definitely understand. But I know why it's gotten to this point. And it's really sad. It's sad that we've gotten to this point where we have to literally, you know, loot and riot just to get our point across when we've tried for 400 years, you know, 400 years in this country being peaceful. And we've had amazing icons that have led the way and shown us different paths of how to, you know, how to seek justice and how to get equal rights and how to get civil rights. You know, but I think now it's a beautiful time. The millennials are here and we're being loud and we're asking, if you want to move forward in this country, if you want a peaceful country, if you want a peaceful life, just give us some respect. That's all we ask. Give us some respect. Give us some justice. Let us know that our lives actually matter.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. My guest is Rael Black. He's the founder of the Community Healing Project in Daytona Beach. I want to introduce as well our other guest, Sheriff Mike Chitwood from Volusia County. Sheriff Chitwood, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thank you for joining us. I want to just kind of get your reaction for a start to the demonstrations. Have they sort of prompted a bit of soul searching for you?
Well, thank God our protests have been peaceful. Mm-hmm. They have been a cross-section of society, white, black, brown, yellow, purple, people from the same people from different socioeconomic backgrounds. And it's been interesting and refreshing to see that because it's the First Amendment in action.
Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of footage here in Orlando and across the country of, in some instances, police officers kneeling with protesters, praying with them, you know, kind of taking a knee. Have you seen that in Volusia County as well?
Well, I haven't seen that in our demonstrations, but, you know, everybody is entitled to their right to protest or whatever they feel. I don't condemn or condone either way. Everybody has to do what they believe is right in their heart.
Sheriff Chitwood, when you hear that phrase, defund police, what does that mean to you?
I think it's ludicrous. I think that the people that are screaming to defund the police are playing to a political ideology and throwing out red meat to them. Because I'll give you an example, the two quick examples. Mammoth University did a poll last week. 7 out of 10 Americans across racial lines said that they are overall satisfied with the service and direction of their local police departments. This week alone, I've been contacted by 7 different residents in 7 different areas of the county who's asked me to increase patrols for traffic issues in their neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about defunding the police, keep something in mind here. When you defund us, the first place that we have to cut, where we only have fat in our budget, is training and technology. And to get, I heard Mr. Black's point, he would be surprised to know we probably have more in common than this than we don't have in common on this issue. A lot of the things that we handle, mental illness, homelessness, school safety issues. We handle those issues because the federal government and the state government and county government and city government said, we're not dealing with this. Mm-hmm. We're going to turn it over to the cops. And that's why we're in the position that we're in now.
Well, Raul, let me throw that question to you. What does that expression defunding the police mean for you? And perhaps there's some nuance that we're not hearing.
Definitely. First of all, good afternoon, Sheriff Chitwood. I just want to say first, just the overall defund the police. I just want to just break that down. I think that whichever group decided to promote that idea, I wish they would have, or whatever PR team decided to promote that idea and that phrase, I wish they would have done a little more, just made it a little more digestible for people. As a lot of people have stated, a lot of panelists and a lot of pundits have talked about, defunding the police doesn't mean abolishing the police or dismantling the police, because mm-hmm. that'd be absolutely ludicrous, like you said, Sheriff. That'd be chaotic.
Although to be fair, that is also something you will see on placards and billboards at some of these protests. But continue.
Yeah, no, I definitely understand what it means, but I think a lot of people are getting misconstrued. When we say defund the police, and this is something that I definitely feel strongly about, it's not saying dismantling the police. It's not saying close police stations. It's not saying take police stations out of cities. What it's saying is for cities like New York City that have a $6.5 billion annual budget, you know, it's saying maybe we should reallocate some of those funds to some of the programs that are going on in the community and to some of those disenfranchised communities that may need those funds. We've seen throughout history, we've seen the most the communities that the police occupy the most are low-income communities, communities where people are at risk, disadvantaged, people who usually don't have jobs, people who usually don't have transportation, people who don't have access to health care. And those are the communities that the police occupy the most. So in my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of people my age, a lot of people that are out here, we're saying that, hey, we're not asking you to destabilize police officers. We're not asking you to shut it down, because that would be chaotic. And we need, like I just said, I just got hit by a car. Guess who the first person we called? The police. You know, so I would never say shut down police stations. But however, I am asking that as a nonprofit organization, as an organization that does need support and is out here in the community and does touch hands and has reached lives and has really changed lives, you know, we could definitely use some of the support that some of these police stations may be getting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not one to pull audits, and I'm not one to ask for that. But a lot of people have said, they've given me quotes about, say, $60 million of my city's budget goes to the police station. I say if we had 3% of that, maybe 5% of that, and reallocated it towards, you know, better healthcare facilities in the city, you know, public education system, you know, put back some of those cultural and performing arts programs back in the schools. And I like how the sheriff said, you know, the city may not want to deal with some of those things, so they give it to the police department. But I think the problem is, if the city dealt with it and let the community deal with it and let community organizers and organizations and let some of these, you know, some of these facilities deal with it, we could minimize crime. We wouldn't have to have as he said, the outpouring of police officers on our streets. We could reallocate those police officers and reallocate that. And instead of, you know, placing more officers into healthy communities, you repurpose that money and put it into public housing and job opportunities and funds for small businesses in those communities, so you don't have the crime. You know, of course, it won't eradicate crime. Nothing's going to eradicate crime. I understand that. But if you come out and say, put $2 million into a community reserve pot that says, you know, we're going to have money for agriculture. We're going to have money for small businesses. We're going to have access to health care, regardless how much money you make. You know, these are the kind of issues that my community deal with. And I was born and raised, Sheriff Chitwood, he knows, Daytona Beach. I was born and raised in Caroline Village. It's not the most beautiful neighborhood. It's not the most progressive neighborhood. But I am a product of my neighborhood. I'm proud of where I'm from. But I know that my neighborhood needs help. We need better social services for mental health. Mm-hmm. We need to, you know, food and grocery options. So if there is a way, if there's any way possible, like I said, I would never, absolutely never say destroy the police station. I would never say shut down police officers, because we need them. Like I just said, it's going to hit by a car, and the first person we call was a police officer.
Right.
So I definitely would love if some of those funds got reallocated, not to go on too much, but that's really my
quite a lot to unpack there. I do want to get to a couple of questions we're getting on Twitter. Newsy Woozy wrote, he has actually a few questions here, but a couple of things he's asking about are what it would cost to train police in alternatives to gun usage. And he's also asking about the Camden solution, which he says nearly doubled the police presence in that county, that's in New Jersey, and asking if that plan could work here. And just from my reading of what happened in Camden, New Jersey, is they essentially dismantled and then reformed the police.
Crime decreased 25%.
Indeed. I want to ask about the first thing, though, about training. And Sheriff Chitwood, I mean, to your point earlier about the Sheriff's Office, I know you've been sort of working on some of the de-escalation training and the like. How important is training and how expensive is it to train police to use other means than potentially deadly force?
Yeah, let me first tell you that, to Mr. Black's point, the greatest cop that I ever met in the world was called Economic Development, and I'll leave it at that one. Training that we do, I mean, I'll give you an example. You can't train in a vacuum. All of Volusia County or all of Orange County or all of Seminole County, if you train together constantly, mm-hmm. you get groupthink. So the objective is when we do training, we want people to go to different parts of the country, and in some cases where I went to Scotland, to look at other democracies. In Scotland's case, they don't carry firearms.
Right.
They still deal with mentally ill people with firebombs and knives and machetes. How do they handle it? How do they recruit? How do they train? Some of those techniques we brought back to Daytona Beach, and obviously we brought to the sheriff's office. One is the duty to intervene. You know, do you want a warrior police force or a guardian police force? The duty to intervene is what guardians do. Our de-escalation training, we had an outside agency come in, the Police Executive Research Forum, which is a Washington-based think tank. They spent a year here. They went through our policies, our procedures, our training, our culture, and then issued a 90-page report, which you could read online. Every deputy, including myself, has gone through that. We reduced use of force by 60% in 2019, the first year we were done.
Mm-hmm.
We've also given out 24 de-escalation medals where there were situations where deadly force could have been used, but it wasn't. And as a result of that, the person was taken into custody without a shot being fired. So these are the things that you have to look. And the other thing is the standards of training are different everywhere you go. You know, there's 18,000 police departments in this country. Everybody doesn't train the same. Mm-hmm. And the smaller police departments probably don't really train at all. Or train to the level that the bigger ones do. So there's a lot of food for thought here when you discuss these things. I think if you can shout out the far right and the far left and take a deep breath and bring folks to the table to have a discursive debate, George Floyd's death will be exactly what his 6-year-old daughter said, my daddy changed the world. And you have the momentum now for that to happen. There's people across the line that want to see change. If you get the cooler heads to prevail, get politics out of it, you can see real headway on the social justice side as well as on the law enforcement side.
That conversation with Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood and Rel Black, founder of the Community Healing Project in Daytona Beach, first aired in June. Still to come, how do the protests of 2020 compare to the civil rights marches of the 1960s? That conversation when Intersection returns. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. 2020 has seen a new generation of protesters take to the streets to demand change and an end to police brutality. Pastor Roderick Zack of Rejoice in the Lord Ministries in Orlando says the protesters are bringing attention to inequality and injustice that hasn't been dealt with. We spoke to Zack on Intersection back in June, along with Dr. Eric Smore, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Rollins College, about parallels between protests today and protests from the 1960s, and the need for systemic change.
Dr. Small, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Matthew, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by Pastor Roderick Zack of Rejoice in the Lord Ministries. Pastor Zack, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for the invitation, Matt.
Let me start by asking what both of you are thinking about as you witness the protests across this country. Pastor Zack, what's going through your mind?
Well, it is in response to, unfortunately, unlawful, brazen, merciless, atrocious killings, the killing of George Floyd. And unfortunately, this in the first instance, maybe probably the most stark.
Mm-hmm.
But, and, you know, so the protests are happening to bring attention to disparity, inequality, injustices. And and just a historic problem that hasn't really been adequately dealt with yet. So I think it's highlighting things. Unfortunately, there are some players that are acting out, but protesters are not necessarily looters. I mean, you know, and looters are looters, mm-hmm. and protesters are protesters. So hopefully, you know, we can get some handle on the criminality that's happening. But there's an outcry. Dr. Martin Luther King said that riot is the voice of the unheard, in essence. So I do understand it. I'm an African American male. I've been unfortunately harassed by the police myself, and so it's something that has to be done. And it's wonderful to see such a diverse crowd, you know, that whites and Hispanics and Asians and African Americans, and it's just wonderful to see that happening. And I'm glad for that day that it's not, you know, us, to use the term, crying in the wilderness mm-hmm. By ourselves, but more so there's a more united voice. If the powers that be can be sensitive and hear beyond just the outward demonstration of anger and get to the source of the problems.
Dr. Eric Smore, what are you thinking about and thinking about, especially as you watch what's unfolding here in Central Florida across the nation over the last few weeks, and you know these protests have been growing in strength and they don't seem to be going away.
So what's going through my mind is that African Americans have been the victims of police brutality and institutional oppression since the end of the Civil War. And many people, of course, thought that after the Civil Rights Movement, those things went away. But it turns out that police brutality has always been with us. It's just that after the Civil Rights Movement, the cameras went away. With the camcorders and the cell phones, we're able to record what's happening in black and brown communities and put it on social media like Facebook that didn't exist previously. Mm-hmm. And then with in-depth reporting, anybody can go onto the internet and see all of the institutional oppression that exists in our criminal justice system. So the first thing that's going through my mind is that this stuff has always been with us. It hasn't gone away. And the second thing that's going through my mind is that young people are demanding that we give them what we promised that we would give them, and that's a just society. And you see young people from all backgrounds demanding that we give them justice. And I think it's time that we stand up with them and demand of our politicians that they change the systems that have existed for a long time.
Here at WMFE, we've heard from a couple of listeners who draw comparisons between the demonstrations we're seeing now and the demonstrations that they took part in and witnessed in the 1960s. What do you make of that comparison, Dr. Smore?
Protesters have been keen to draw a distinction between themselves and the people who have caused property damages. And then, of course, news outlets have reported that there are outside people coming into the protest and causing property damage. We saw that same tactic with the civil rights movement. There were people who attempted to infiltrate Dr. King's civil rights movement and then caused property damage for the purpose of denigrating the movement. So that's the first comparison that I want to draw. The second comparison that I want to draw is that there's nothing new about people who don't have democratic outlets for change or whose politicians have ignored them for years, engaging in protests. And some of our most celebrated protests, we find that the protest often leads to property damage. Mm-hmm. The Boston Tea Party is a story about property damage. When we look at the Hong Kong protesters, we find that there's been over $600 million in property damage. And so although the protesters today aren't engaged in that, there are people from the outside coming in, if people aren't paid attention to, or if they don't have democratic means for making change, you will see their anger and frustration spill over into property damage.
Mm-hmm. Pastor Zach, your thoughts on the sort of comparisons between what we're seeing now and what we saw in the 60s?
Yeah, during the 60s, it was a more establishment-oriented, Christian-led movement. The whole process of mobilization was different. The focus on nonviolence was heavy, and there was even though it was still visceral, very folks still angry. They were trained and it was a process prior to participating in the march. And here, you know, you got the event of social media, concise communication that they're making. It's more grassroots. There's no really definitive leader. So it's a stark difference. And so hopefully some leaders, some definitive leaders will be birthed from this in terms of some spokespersons that can lead the way to the process of solutions, strategies, tactics, a whole paradigm shift, and that's what's being called for. So I'm hoping and praying that that will be the next steps in this.
Eric Smore, I just wonder, sort of, is this a moment where we all really need to take a step and sort of reflect and say, okay, how do we get to this point?
This is an excellent question. I want to take us back to 2006. The FBI published a report called the Intelligence Assessment Report, in which they told us that white supremacists have infiltrated our police departments in many cities throughout the country. This fact was reconfirmed by the Department of Homeland Security in a report called the Joint Intelligence Report. The Ku Klux Klan called their members who have infiltrated policing departments ghost Klansmen because they hold all of the traditional beliefs of Ku Klux Klansmen, but they don't act in traditional ways. So, for example, they don't wear the sheets and they don't use typical racist language. I call these people asymptomatic racists. At the extreme end of asymptomatic racism, you'll have Ku Klux Klansmen who have infiltrated policing departments, and that's where you get this brutalization of African Americans and Hispanic Americans in many cities throughout the country. You also get false arrests and unwarranted convictions of people, and hopefully I'll have a chance to talk about that later. But at the less extreme end of asymptomatic racism, you get people like Amy Cooper, who calls the police on Christian Cooper and issues a false report about him in Central Park. So to the question of how did we get here, there has been a process of moving, or at least a process from the Ku Klux Klansmen, of moving their members out of sheets and into policing departments so that they can act under the color of law. And even when they do things like we saw in Minnesota with George Floyd, they get the protection of qualified immunity, and therefore they don't end up in jail under most conditions.
What do you see going forward? Like, what do you think the next few months looks like, if it's even possible to sort of see that far out at this point?
Well, I think some think tanks are already developing that has some major people involved in developing like a task force that considers this from a comprehensive way and to innovate, to be creative in how we look at policing and, first try to analyze and take best practices and implement those, but also think about different ways that we can, for instance, we can electronically issue a ticket. Is it a way that we can, some of our officers in our church said the most fearful experience they have is when they approach a vehicle. Is there a way that we can mitigate that? Is there a way that we can minimize approaching vehicles? It can't be apprehension at any cost. So is there a value system in the police system that says, okay, if you have a blank incident where you don't make an apprehension, do you get penalized for that? So how can we do policing that's more investigative, that's more more involved in, waiting sometimes as opposed to jumping right in if it's a nonviolent scenario? And so
Those are the things that have to be considered. And voices and thinkers and sociologists and psychologists, have to come in and help the police department come up with a new paradigm, a new model that's more than them adjusting themselves. Mm-hmm. And hopefully government authorities will be involved in that because they're supposed to be the overseers. And it's going to take some legislation, but it also is going to take some local action, regional action to make a difference. And that's what we're going for in Orange County and the counties surrounding us in the Central Florida area.
That conversation with Pastor Roderick Zack of Rejoice in the Lord Ministries in Orlando and Dr. Eric Smore, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Rollins College, first aired in June. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.